Okay, so today we're going to be talking about perturbation theory in GR, which is, if you're in practice doing gravity, you more or less can't get away in many sort of applications of gravity of having to do some perturbation theory. So I'm going to just recall that when we talked about the action, we and varying the action, I noted that Palatini lemma about the variation of Ricci, and then wrote it in terms of variations of the metric. Now, note here, we're talking about an HAB that is the variation of GAB, so annoyingly, not the variation of the inverse of G, which is what we do with the action. So here, this would be R observable. So when LIGO measures strain, it's actually measuring a sort of gauge invariant part of this H, this perturbation tensor. So it's how much distances are changing. And so what I want to do is today is to talk about the wave equation that that H satisfies, and then to talk about perturbations of black holes. Hopefully without getting a coughing fit. So what this, if we, so this was as we wrote it down when we were doing the action, but notice that the indices are not quite right. So let me see, what have I done wrong? CAB, so that must be CA, there we go. So if you notice, this is a contracted index, right? That grad C. But there's another covariant derivative lying between that contraction. So it just suggests that we should swap that ordering of derivatives so that we can then say we have some sort of divergence. So the reasoning will gradually become apparent, but at least in terms of things looking tidy, here we've got an operator, the D'Alembertian on HAB, and if we kind of swap the order of these derivatives, then we're going to have a divergence of H. So we just remember sort of the Riemann identity. So when you remember, when you swap the order of derivatives, that's that the commutator of the covariant derivative is giving you the curvature. And we talked about it when I talked about the curvature, I just did it acting on a vector. So, so that first bit, what you see is you first of all transport those original ordering of covariant derivative indices to the final two indices of Riemann. That was the definition, so that's the CA there. And then in the first instance, you're replacing this C index. So that's your first taking the commutator acting on this vector bit. So the C goes to there and is contracted. And then the second bit is the commutator on the covector bit. So we get the B downstairs and contract here with that D index. And so what we get Okay, so we get a bunch of, when we swap the order of differentiation, we pick up a bunch of Riemann and Ricci's. And this, so that's where these two pieces come from. And then, as advertised, what we then get is a divergence acting on H. But when we kind of do all the accounting and the dust settles, it ends up being a divergence of what we call this H bar. So we get the symmetrized part of the divergence of H and then a double derivative acting on the trace of H. So this is known as the Lichnerowicz operator. So it's the curved space wave operator acting on spin two particles, if you want to think of it that way, gravitons, or on tensor perturbations of your space-time. So I know you've sort of met gravitational waves, at least I think around flat space. So if you were in flat space, there would be no Riemann or Ricci, so all that complication would have gone. And then you would have just these derivatives of the perturbation. So let me just say a bit about choices of gauge. Because in general, H is symmetric like the metric, so it has 10 independent components. But we strongly suspect, just like when we're solving for the Einstein equation, that some of those components can be removed by a suitable choice of coordinates. So let's think about gauge. So under a gauge transformation, we have our coordinates, at least infinitesimally. So coordinate transformations are generated by vectors. So if psi is infinitesimal, this is what we'd get. So you can think of psi as sort of being small. So under this gauge transformation, the metric if it changes at all, will change by the Lie derivative along that curve. So remember when we talked about Lie derivatives, we were talking about sort of shifting along integral curves of a vector field. And we said that, you know, we sort of said that the Lie derivative was telling us about the incremental change in an object as we moved along the integral curves of the vector field. So that means this would be our metric perturbation, if non-zero. And so our perturbation, which is the Lie derivative, is the symmetrized derivative of psi. So changing coordinates generates a perturbation in the strictest sense. It changes the components of the metric. So that obviously sort of is the clue that it's solving that equation is not necessarily going to be, I mean, even if you can solve it, you haven't finished your job, because you have to then decide if what you found is a physical perturbation. And there are several examples in the literature where people have made a claim about something, you know, about a sort of variation of a metric, thinking that they've got some new physical result, whereas in fact it's just a gauge result. So let's have a look at what happens to our h-bar. Oh, where is it here? To this trace reversed in four dimensions perturbation. So this is my h. I take the divergence. So the first bit gives me the wave operator of psi. The second bit gives me this ordering, grad A, grad B of psi. And then my trace is just the divergence of psi. And so this last piece is just giving me the gradient of the divergence of psi. But then you see that what we've got here is a commutator of derivatives, so I can use the Riemann identity to replace that with curvature. So this is a curved space wave equation for a vector. So at this point, we appeal to some mathematics. That this is a well-posed differential equation, which means that if we have an initial data surface and this object on the left is non-zero for our original perturbation, then we can solve this equation. This becomes a source. We solve it and find a psi, and then we subtract that h psi ab from our original h ab, so that when we now take the divergence of the new h bar, we get zero. So this is a very common gauge that you'll see in perturbation theory in GR. It's called the Dodonda gauge, and it is that the trace of this h-bar is zero. You will also often see TTF, which is transverse trace-free, which means that h equals zero is grad A HAB. But just a word of warning, you can only take that gauge in vacuum because h couples to matter content. So it's just, you know, it's strictly, this is true for any perturbation. Transverse trace free is only true vacuum perturbations. So if you count the degrees of freedom, which I know you've already met before, there's still gauge freedom in H because I can do a coordinate transformation, and as long as that combination, that sort of generalized curved space wave operator, is zero, then my Dodonda gauge remains unchanged. So just a quick counting. This has, it's in D dimensions, it has D solutions, because it's D equations. And so the original degrees of freedom we have to think about what we've got. So originally, we start off with D into D plus 1 on 2. So that's the number of independent components of a symmetric tensor. Then we've got, so that's the components of HAB. Then we minus D, so this is the gauge constraints. And then we minus another D, because that's the remaining freedom. And so what we get is D into D minus 3 on 2. So if D is 4, the number is 2. If D is 5, the number is 5. And so on and so forth. So that's perhaps a different way that you of seeing the number of degrees of freedom in the gravitational field. Okay, so that's the sort of just a brief overview of how you do perturbation theory. So now I want to talk about, rather than gravitational waves, which I understand you've met, I want to talk about perturbations of a black hole or a black string.
HAB has a different number of degrees of freedom than D equals 5. Does that mean that the spin of the graviton is different?
No, it's just that's the number of degrees of freedom of the graviton in 5 dimensions. It's also the number of degrees of freedom of a massive graviton in 4 dimensions.
A massive graviton.
Yeah, so it's you get this sort of relation that the, you know, if you're in D dimensions, the number of degrees of freedom of the massless field is kind of the same as the number of degrees of freedom of a massive field in 1 dimension down. So in 5 dimensions, so in 4 dimensions, you have this sort of, you know, the quadrupole nature of gravitational radiation. So if you think of your circle kind of oscillating in and out, the polarizations are either the plus or the cross. And so roughly speaking, in 5D, you've now sort of got, I guess, I mean, this is probably flaky, but I think about it as sort of in 5D, your 4 spatial dimensions have 2, you can split it into 2 orthogonal planes, and so you can sort of think of it as a plus and a cross in each of those, which gives you 4, and then some sort of diagonal mode. That was probably slightly flaky, but yeah, I must admit, it's, yeah. So by the time you, I can't remember, what's the answer in 10? It's 5 times 7, 35 degrees of freedom in 10 dimensions. So it kind of explodes very, very quickly. So but it's still a tensor mode. It's just that you have so many more degrees of freedom.
So you still would call it a massless spin two particle in D equals five?
So I do, yeah. I mean, I think one of the most sort of interesting things in the last decade or so is a proper development of massive gravity. But at the same time, it is the level of complexity has just exponentiated. I think sticking with massless gravity, there's, in terms of observational evidence, it's a totally reasonable thing to do. Massless gravity, I hope I said. So black hole perturbations. Here I'm going to just be pointing you to Reggie and Wheeler, which is Phys Rev 108. And this is in 1957. So before the Kerr solution was discovered, so relativists were obviously trying to think about, this object like the black hole, well, which wasn't a black hole then. I just got told yesterday that I haven't seen the movie Oppenheimer. I don't know if anyone here has, but at some point they actually commit a sin of anachronism where they're discussing the collapse of Oppenheimer-Snyder collapse. And then, they actually say, the star could form a black hole. But black hole wasn't coined till the mid-60s by John Wheeler. So, yeah. So anyway, they weren't called black hole perturbations at the time. But people that were wrestling with this problem of what was this Schwarzschild solution, was it really physical or not? And you need to worry about it. If the solution is unstable, then you don't really need to worry about it because it won't form during collapse. So this was sort of part of this whole push to try and understand the Schwarzschild solution better. So if you need to do black hole perturbations, it's one of these things where you kind of have to clear an afternoon, take a deep breath, and then just, go at it. Because as conceptually it's not too complicated, but calculationally it's quite formidable. So what they did was they decomposed. So this is some Schwarzschild perturbations. So you're familiar with scalar spherical harmonics. If you then move on to vector spherical harmonics, you see things get more complex. And if you go to tensor spherical harmonics, then you've jacked up the algebraic sort of complexity even further. And so what they proved or demonstrated was that there were solutions that were, you could break them down into their parity class. So there were solutions that were sort of even parity and solutions that were odd parity, but there are no S waves for the Schwarzschild. And the reason for that is that gravitational radiation is quadrupole. So, and a spherical perturbation would be monopole-like. So an example of a sort of one of these basis elements of H So here's an example of one of the Reggie Wheeler basis functions. So this would be e to the minus I omega t sine theta d theta pl of cos theta. So this example has no phi dependence, so it's got zero z orbital angular momentum, but it has a theta dependence, an r dependence, and of course a time dependence. So here you put this e to the I omega t because you're expecting this to be a gravitational wave, so you're sort of expecting it to fluctuate, and so that is that's coming from the d by dt killing vector. You expect to have some sort of Fourier type of transform in time. From the theta and phi directions, because you have SO3 symmetry, you expect somewhere for spherical harmonics to come in. So you expect to see Legendre functions. So that is... Well, they kind of knew, you know, that those would be the various ingredients that would crop up. But of course, what you have to do is to do that full perturbation equation, and then you've got to sort of see explicitly how the different pieces, you know, which pieces do not, amongst all the different ways that you can take, for example, the eigenfunctions in the theta and phi direction, you know, which of these don't couple to each other. So it's a bit... So the functions the theta, phi, and t behavior is familiar and straightforward. What becomes difficult, as opposed to doing just flat space decomposition, is the radial equation. And so what you end up with is a potential here, which is... I guess that's 6gm. So just recall that F is 1 minus 2gm on R. So here, L is the angular momentum of the perturbation, which has got from that PL. Okay, so that's just sort of saying that you can decompose the equation of motion for perturbations of the Schwarzschild black hole. So now, I just want to apply that to that instability of the black string, which I finished with yesterday, so that from thermodynamic considerations, this is an order of magnitude, so it's something around that scale where, from the entropic perspective, the black string starts to look unstable. So for this metric, this was the black string metric. For that metric, you have the same sort of decomposition, but with this extra dimension. So in other words, all you do is get an extra parameter mu, which is telling you about the Fourier decomposition in the extra dimension. So here, mu is related to 1 over L. So I say 2 pi, it's actually 2 pi n for some n in z, some integer n. So we've got a Fourier series rather than a Fourier transform in terms of the z direction. So remember I was saying about the massless wave equation in five dimensions being equivalent to the massive, or the degrees of freedom being equivalent to the massive wave equation in four dimensions. You can kind of see this now. So let me just take a particular simple example. So this is what the S wave would look like, but in essence, that's just a specific example of the four-dimensional solution. If you were to just replace this bit by a sort of perturbation which only depended on the four-dimensional coordinates, then what you would get would be this operator. So you can, because you've just really bolted on a flat direction, you can show that the five-dimensional Lichnerowicz reduces to a four-dimensional Lichnerowicz plus a mass term. And so here explicitly you're seeing how the massless mode in five dimensions is the number of degrees of freedom there is the same as a massive mode in 4D. So just to make a couple of comments about this structure, first of all, note that I haven't put e to the minus I omega t here. So this is because I'm actually looking for an instability. So here, omega is really minus I omega, so I'm looking for an imaginary frequency. So the other thing is that this part, this 4x4 square, this is the sort of tensor part from a four-dimensional perspective. This is the tensor perturbation. This one here, is the vector. It's a vector as far as 4D is concerned. And this one is a scalar. So again, this also has echoes of cosmology. When you're doing perturbation theory in cosmology, it's different there because things depend only on time. So you decompose with respect to the spatial symmetry. And so when you talk about tensor, vector, and scalar modes there, you're talking about them with respect to the lower dimensional space. So it's, you've got the one extra dimension here, it's Z, in cosmology it's T. And so you get these, you can decompose perturbations into their irreducible representations under the lower dimensional symmetry group. So just to proceed, if we look at the scalar mode, so this bit's relatively easy. So we've got that our scalar is a massive scalar. So there's no angular dependence. So the equation for my scalar is pretty straightforward. It's got the plus mu squared piece. It's got the plus omega squared. But of course, GTT is F. So I've got omega squared on F there. And so now this is just a simple ODE. And I can look at what happens at each end. So when R goes to infinity, F goes to 1. This bit is small, and so I've got h double primed is mu squared plus omega squared h. So h is proportional to the exponential of the square root of omega squared plus mu squared r. Then when I go to 2gm, f is going to 0. So now this bit is the most important one there. So that's going to 0 like r minus 2gm. This is finite, and this prefactor goes to 0. So I can see that h is going to go to 0 like a power of r minus 2gm. And omega is what's driving it, so it turns out it's plus or minus 2gm omega. So for regularity, I need to have the decaying solution at infinity and the solution that goes to 0 at the horizon. So then the argument is, if I can, so here's my R, it's 2gm. If I can link the solution that's going to 0 here, that's that one, together with the solution decaying at infinity, then I'm finished. I've got a solution to that wave equation. So I just sketch an arbitrary curve that joins those two. So if there exists a solution, so this is the classic proof by contradiction, So if there exists a solution, then there exists a maximum. So h primed equals zero at maximum. But if h primed is zero, then this term is negative. So this term is positive. The whole thing's zero. So this term equals this term. And therefore, h double primed is positive. But if h double primed is positive, that turning point has to be a maximum. So we have found a contradiction. So if I am looking for an instability, I'm not going to find it in H55. I then remove that component from the original expression and turn the handle again and look at the vector part. And a similar argument, though it's a bit more complicated, leads to the same conclusion. So the only thing that's left is the tensor mode. And the tensor mode has to satisfy a four-dimensional massive Lichnerowicz equation. So I just want to make a note at this point. Sorry, let me keep the mu new. So if I have a gauge mode in four dimensions, then it satisfies the four-dimensional Lichnerowicz operator. That was sort of implicit in that discussion over there. And so if I find a solution to this equation, it is physical, because I know that any gauge degree of freedom is a massless one. I then do turn the handle. Because I'm in vacuum, I can take that transverse trace-free gauge. So I use all my gauge constraints. So for example, taking the trace to be zero means I can rewrite k in terms of HTT and HRR. And I've then got the divergence condition. So there's two of those remaining. And so what I end up with is a second order differential equation for just one of the components, say HTR. So obviously there's quite a lot of algebra there, because if you're going to write down that Lichnerovich operator, you've got to compute all the Riemanns, all the Ricci's, go through, make sure you've done all the contractions, kept all the pieces, and then put it all together properly, used your gauge constraints to get rid of functions so that you just end up with this minimal degree of freedom. However, what I'm going to do, rather than obviously do that level of algebra, I'm going to just write down what equations that you end up with. So it's quite common that you can either have a second-order differential equation or two first-order ones. So here, the degrees of freedom... Sorry, little h. So what you get is, I mean, here I've written it just for to make the equations look neater. I've written it in terms of h plus and h minus, but h plus is just given as a function of h minus and h. So really here, this h plus is just standing in for a bit of a mess in terms of an expression in terms of h minus and h. And so when you look again, you do the same argument, look at the boundaries. So you get the same exponential fall off as you had before, which is sort of to be expected because it's a massive behavior. And then near the horizon, where I'm going to use R plus just to be so at the horizon, you've got, again, a sort of quite a similar behavior to the scalar, but you've got, you know, as in you've got the two branches, but notice that whereas this one branch is regular, with this one, it sort of looks like one branch, both branches might actually be singular. So here, thank you. So here, this is just an opportunity to kind of remind you of some of the mathematical theory that goes behind taking Fourier series, or indeed decomposing with respect to any complete set of functions. So the idea is that you're interested in a solution to this equation or whatever equation you're analyzing, and rather than sort of trying to solve it straight out for some given initial data surface, if you're thinking about it more theoretically, you know, more abstractly, what you sort of say is, oh, but I know my background has symmetries, so I'm going to decompose into eigenfunctions with respect to those symmetries, but a general solution will always be a sum of these eigenfunctions. So there, you're actually doing a vector space. You're saying your space of functions is a vector space, and you're saying I'm picking a basis for my vector space, be it Fourier modes, Legendre functions, whatever. And then I'm going to use some theorems from mathematics about self-adjoint operators to say that my general solution is expressible as a sum of these. But the key step there is completeness. Your basis has to be complete. So if you ignore both of these solutions, you have violated that condition of completeness. Yep.
How is the positive branch singular?
Because if omega r plus is less than 1, this blows up. So it looks like it's singular, for omega r plus less than 1. So, however, what you've got to do is to look at a local non-singular coordinate system. So we did that with Kruskal's. So here I'm just going to take my Kruskal's. So this is based on Kruskal's. I'm keeping a sort of time-like and space-like coordinate. So remember, R star is the tortoise coordinate. Then what you get, for example, is that HTT, which is proportional when you put all these things in, so this is what you get under that coordinate transformation. But then as you go to the origin, R tends to T. So you see it potentially blowing up. But you know that H plus tends to either plus or minus 2H. So now you can sort of see that this makes that whole bracket go to a perfect square. And we know that H minus is OK. But what we get so in other words, if I take the upper root, my perturbation is regular. So this is just one of the prices that you have to pay if you do things in Schwarzschild coordinates, It's obviously easier because you have the staticity giving you your Fourier transform in T, but then you've got to grapple with the fact that those coordinates are singular at the horizon. So you have to be careful to make sure that you pick non-singular solutions in a locally non-singular frame. So in other words, it's kind of the coordinate frame that's misleading us there. So then we finding solutions to the becomes an eigenvalue problem. So you start off with your solution at the horizon. You know you've got the exponentially decaying solution at infinity. You integrate them in. And then if they don't quite match, you adjust your omega and try again. And what you end up with is some sort of approximately parabola curve. So our thermodynamics gave that R plus mu should be less than 32 over 27 in order for the instability to kick in. And what you find is it's round about 0.9. So it's close. And so this process is actually really just a particular case of a more general problem, which again applies going back to 4D Schwarzschild. So you have, just in general for black holes, you end up with this sort of structure that you have a differential equation, you have a frequency, and you have some form of effective potential. Your Q has to be decaying at infinity, and it also, so Q has to look something like e to the minus I omega T minus R at infinity and e to the minus I omega T plus R star at the black hole horizon. And so if you're thinking not just about a perturbation, but if you think about, well, what actually happens if I sort of kick a black hole, then you think about, so in other words, you're sort of doing some immediate perturbation in the here and now, then your boundary conditions at the horizon have to be that everything is falling in. Meanwhile, at infinity, you sort of expect all these waves to be outgoing. And so in other words, what you've got is a general flux of energy away from the system. So energy is seeping out of the system and being lost. So in essence, if I think about energy being lost, I can draw an analogy with a damped harmonic oscillator, because that kind of slows down the oscillations. And so when I do that, I still expect kind of solutions for my omega, but this time I'm expecting them to be complex because I expect a decay. So let me just quickly sketch how that works. So I'll sketch it with a scalar field. So as before, we do this separation of variables. We decompose in terms of the harmonics. So curly phi is the coordinate, straight phi is the scalar. And so we get that so you see, we get a sort of specific eigenvalue equation. Now, of course, you can put it on the computer, but an analytic model or analytic approximation, and this was by Blohm and Machoon, used a potential that had been explored, I think, in the 30s by Pirschel and Teller. And so it's an inverted, it's a Sech squared potential, inverted Cosh. And here we've got that R star zero is where the maximum of the potential is. V zero, so alpha, is the second derivative at R zero star over V zero. And V zero is VLM of R zero star. And so just to give you an indicator of why they did this without going through the whole thing, if I redefine I actually get a Legendre equation. So obviously, yeah, you can put things on the computer, but you know that we're going back some years now when Blohm and Machoon were doing this. And so getting an analytic, a potential where you can find these eigenvalues analytically, so this is a Legendre equation. The boundary conditions pick out specific values of the lambda and mu. So there's two lambdas, obviously. And so what we find is that omega is plus or minus, putting everything back in, v naught minus alpha squared on 4 minus I alpha, n plus a half. So we have a discrete set of eigenvalues, and if I take, as an example, L goes to infinity, so this is the so-called iconal limit, then V primed is zero at 3R plus on 2, and I get that alpha is 2 over root 3 GM. And so I get this, an omega that's related to M. So in other words, the ring down, this is so-called ring down or quasi-normal modes. So what it says is if you kick the black hole, and a black hole merger is just an absolutely massive kick to a black hole, then you disturb it, it's got to settle down to a final Kerr state. I mean, this is for Schwarzschild, but the same principle applies. And so it's radiating a massive amount of gravitational radiation out to infinity. Some falls through the horizon, but it quickly settles into these sort of characteristic frequencies. So just like a violin string is almost a normal mode, so the sound that you get is almost a normal mode, here it's called quasi-normal because it decays in time. And so this quasi-normal mode, the ringing of the black hole, just like a ringing of a bell decays in time, gives you information about the mass. So with Schwarzschild, the mass is all we've got. But with Kerr, you would get information about the angular momentum as well. So this is why quasi-normal modes are such a big deal. And sorry, Lucy, no, come in. Just finishing. And just to note that there's, you know, that in fact, although I say you can do it numerically, there's sort of well-known issues that if you try and find the Purcell-Teller eigenvalues numerically, there's a consistent sort of discrepancy. And so there's sort of quite an interesting sort of conversation at the moment going on in the literature about the so-called stability of the positions of these quasi-normal modes on the complex plane. And I've well overrun, so maybe next time I'll give a short lecture. Thank you.